that's quite a hard introduction to live up to, and I'm hoping it won't be too disappointing. But what I it's really nice to come here, and what I want to tackle today is the question of HIV vaccine development and why there isn't yet a vaccine. And I realise that most of you aren't involved in lab research, and neither was I for quite a long time, so I still remember what it's like not to know what a T-cell receptor is or an HLA molecule. So hopefully I can try and make explain what we do in ways that are accessible. But I'd be very happy if you want to interrupt me at any stage and say, you know, that's really not clear, and can you talk about that in a different way? Just to tell you a little bit about me, that I started off life as a physician. I trained partly here, partly in Cambridge, and ended up being involved in HIV work from a very early stage as a junior doctor. And I, in fact, I'll explain that about it in my next slide. I went into research as part of my clinical training, because in infectious diseases medicine, it's usual for doctors to do a PhD, and then sort of got hooked, and in particular got hooked on working on the problems of HIV in the developing world. And I think that's probably where we have quite a lot in common with the kind of interest that you have. And so for several years, as you've just heard, I worked as a research director in the MRC labs in the Gambia, which is an old, well-established research institute. It's been there since the 1940s. The Gambia is a very small country, and this is a very small unit, but it's had a profound effect on a number of different areas of public health, particularly in malaria and in the development of vaccines. And the HIV research wasn't the biggest part of the work there, but it was obviously something I was very involved with when we were based there. And when I talk to you about the Gambia, I'll also explain a little bit about how politics can impact on science. So the reason for showing this slide is not because you need to know the background. I imagine you all know these key pieces of information, but is to remind me to show you this picture. The scan on the top is a brain scan of the first person I looked after when I was a junior doctor. So this is in the 1980s, and I was a fairly newly qualified what was called then a senior house officer. It's now got a different abbreviation. And I was working in infectious diseases, first of all in neurology, where this man came in, and then he ended up on the infectious disease ward, where I'm rotated to a few months later. And this man's case was really the reason that my career has turned out the way it has, because he was the first person with HIV to come into our hospital, which is a big teaching hospital in London. And people didn't really understand about HIV at that stage. It was really... So when all they knew it was something very scary. And so it was known that there was a case of AIDS on the unit, everybody sort of, you know, began to be quite panicky. So when the porters took him for an X-ray, they all dressed up in kind of protection suits, which clearly they didn't need to, but they felt they had to at that time. And this was a young gay man who had moved to London from Scotland. He worked in a bar, and he was in his mid-20s. And he presents, for the doctors in the audience, you'll see, I think even without being a doctor, you can probably see there's a lump here, which isn't where there's no symmetry, and this lump is a toxoplasma granuloma, which nowadays you don't see very often because people at that stage in HIV disease take Ceftriaxone and that prevents it. But it was a very characteristic presentation of AIDS in the early days. And he presented with a fit, and the toxo itself isn't very difficult to treat, but it meant that his immune system had got to the stage where he was susceptible to opportunistic infections. So he had the diagnosis made, and at that stage there was no AZT, there was no antiretrovirals of any sort, so it was a terminal diagnosis, and we expected him to die within 6 months or a year. And I'd looked after terminally ill people before, and it's always quite traumatic as a doctor, but what was so much more so striking about this young man was that he lost all the things that would normally support a person through the terminal stages of their illness. So immediately he lost his job. They didn't want somebody with AIDS working in the bar. And he lived above the bar, so he didn't have anywhere to live. And effectively he lived out his days on our ward because he didn't have anywhere to go. And his family stopped visiting. His sister wanted to visit him, but her husband forbade it because he was worried that the children might get infected. And all his friends stopped visiting because they weren't really sure, you know, what he'd done to catch it and whether they might be susceptible too. So this was somebody not only facing a terminal disease, but they were facing it alone. And I think that was the thing that struck me so much, that HIV wasn't just an awful disease, but it was one where the stigma and the problems associated with people's perception of the disease make it so much worse. And obviously things have moved on since then, but I'm sure many of you who have encountered similar reactions in other parts of the world to HIV and to that diagnosis. Anyway, that's my background. But then through the course of my research work, began to get involved in working in Africa particularly. And as you know, the first cases reported in the 1980s, Harold Jaffe, who used to be in public health here, was involved in the sort of trail back to Africa as a place where HIV was highly prevalent. But the first survey that showed the extent of HIV was in the 1980s, and it was really done by chance in a Nairobi slum called Pumwani. This was a study set up by a Canadian group who are still very involved in HIV research, and we've collaborated with them over many years. And they were set up the study to look at chancroid, which I haven't got any pictures of. It's immediately after lunch, and it's a fairly disgusting genital disease, ulcerating genital disease. And they'd set up the sex worker cohort to look at that, and just because somebody said, oh, you know, I wonder, it might be interesting just to see if any of them have got this new disease. And in fact, they found 2/3 of the sex workers in 1986 already had HIV. And as I'll show later, that rose to much greater heights subsequently. And as you know, it spread rapidly through Africa. There are now considerable success stories in some countries. Zimbabwe, for example, has recently reported a major downturn. Uganda was one of the first countries to see its prevalence fall. But still in parts of sub-Saharan Africa, and particularly in South Africa, there are still very high rates of infection. So in KwaZulu-Natal, it is still the case that one in two women presenting in antenatal clinics will have HIV. And as you all know, this has had a big impact on these countries, on their GDP, on their structures, on their professions, and so on. And it's also been predicted that all the gains that public health measures made over the last century will be reversed by now as a consequence of AIDS. So it's something that's really quite striking. And one of the projects we did at one time was to work with AIDS orphans in Nairobi. And this is a group of them from an orphanage in Nairobi. And just a country the size of Kenya, which has a population of 28 million, a million AIDS orphans is a huge burden. But I suspect I don't need to tell you all of that. But it's still also the case that HIV now is predominantly associated with poverty. And in those places where the highest incidence of HIV is occurring, then it's also the place where treatment access is hardest, to partly because of the cost, although that's been overcome to a certain extent by the Global Fund, but also because of the infrastructure. So in many places, it's simply not possible to deliver antiretrovirals on the scale that are required. So although 5 million people in Africa now have access to antiretrovirals, it's still only a small proportion of those who actually need it. And still in 2009, over 300,000 children were born with HIV, and that's something where biomedically we know how to prevent mother-to-child transmission. So it hasn't gone away, even though, you know, there are encouraging signs to suggest that HIV is declining in many places. And so people have, as this is from earlier this year, when the encouraging signs results came out that if you treat people with in a relationship, you treat the HIV positive person, the chances of them passing HIV on to their partner are significantly reduced. And this led to a speculation that HIV can be prevented simply by treating all infected people. And that would be great if it was possible. I mean, it still is theoretically possible, but it, as I've indicated, two-thirds of the people who need antiretroviral therapy in Africa are not currently receiving it. So there's quite a long way to go before treatment as prevention can be widely used. So there's still a need, I think, to develop a vaccine, and that's what our group has worked on for the last 20 years or so. So let me just go back a little bit into some of the other basics background to HIV. Retroviruses are common in many mammals. Cats have them, cows have them, and mice have them. And often, probably it's over a period of evolution that spans many hundreds of thousands of years, the animal has learnt, the species has learnt to live with its retrovirus. So most naturally infected monkeys or cows don't get sick with their retrovirus. We've got HIV, or people have got HIV, as a relatively recent event. It's thought that that both HIV-1 and HIV-2 came into the to humans in the last century, in the 1930s or 40s. That's part of the problem is that our species hasn't yet adapted to live with HIV. And it may be in millions of years' time, humans will have been selected for those who have good genes that help resist HIV, but we obviously can't wait that long to do something about it. But the important thing and the barrier to a vaccine is that the virus has continued to change since it's entered into people. And I'll explain a bit more about that. The first infection that we're sure about that is well documented took place in, goes back to a sample collected in what is now the DRC, formerly Zaire, formerly quite a few other things, in 1959. And that's the earliest sample that we can be sure of, but it's not clear whether earlier samples didn't have HIV or just that we haven't stored them efficiently enough. And we know roughly what that virus looked like in 1959. The key thing to emphasise is just, and what has made vaccine development so extraordinarily difficult, is that the virus changes very rapidly. Would it be easier if people, if we... I just wonder if that might make it easy to see. Can people see that? Yeah, okay. This is seen as a big problem for vaccine development and drug resistance, but it's also important to realise that this is happening while we haven't got a vaccine. The HIV we now have is much harder to develop a vaccine against than the HIV we had 10 years ago and that we had in 1959 and so on. And the main reason for that is that every time the virus copies, it makes at least one error. And that obviously isn't a great strategy for biological success. But because the virus replicates so rapidly, it can afford to make mistakes. So a lot of the virus at any one time in an infected person is actually rubbish. It's virus that can't go anywhere. It's defective virus. But because the virus, because so many mistakes are made, it also means that it's been estimated within a few weeks of infection, all the possible variants that you can make that are viable have been made in an infected person. So then if you come in with a selection pressure, the immune system, in natural infection, or drugs, or anything, or the equivalent, then the virus has a variant already there that can resist either the immune system or the drugs. And that's why now that we have moved to combination therapy, because if you come at the virus from two or three angles at once, it makes it much harder to develop resistance, although clearly not impossible. And the second way in which the virus evolves is by recombination. So in places where there are many virus variants circulating, if somebody gets infected with two, they can swap genetic material, and that allows even bigger jumps to occur. So both these mechanisms are very important. And the end result is that you have this sort of alphabet of HIV across the world. These things are called phylogenetic trees. And if you think of that as the original virus that came into humans, and this is the 1959 virus, HIV has gone out into all these different families, and these families are continuing to diversify. So as I said earlier, it's much harder to protect against HIV than it would have been 10 years ago, because there's that many more variants around the world. And to give you another example of this, I had my flu jab yesterday because I'm considered as a frontline doctor on the infectious disease ward. And this is a picture that illustrates flu diversity. And we make a new vaccine virtually every year to protect people against flu. This is the variation in one place, and that's the variation across the world for which we make a new vaccine every year. And this is HIV, and so you can imagine that therefore, to generate a vaccine that prevented even against HIV circulating in Oxford would be exceedingly difficult. So these are some of the other things that we know about how the virus works, and this is probably as technical as I'll get, but the virus enters CD4 T cells, and these are really important to the immune system because they coordinate how the immune system responds to a whole variety of challenges. So the helper T cells help make antibodies, which are critical for a lot of pathogens. They help support killer T cells, which I'll show are quite important for controlling HIV. Once you take those out, then you've kind of lost the way of coordinating the immune system. And in particular, HIV has a way of targeting those cells that are specific against the virus itself. So they get lost at a very early stage, and that undermines the whole way in which the body responds to the virus. And it used to be thought that just the entry of the virus into these CD4 cells was enough to account for the fact that they're declining over time. But we now know that there are other things going on, that the immune system is chronically activated as a consequence of various things going on in HIV, and that contributes to the immune system not working properly, even when the CD4 numbers are actually normal. So for most people, the sort of scenario goes like this. Acute infection leads to staggeringly high levels of virus, and this is when people are most infectious. And that comes down quite rapidly in the first few weeks. And what seems to bring it down is the T-cell response to the virus, and I think that's fairly well established now. That all happens within a few weeks of primary infection. The CD4 count goes down in acute infection, then comes up, and then it's stable for quite a while, and declines in a linear fashion until about this point when it sort of takes a sudden inflection. But obviously now we treat, if we can, well before that takes place. And the viral load comes down to a point which is referred to as the set point. The level of set point after a primary infection determines how long people will subsequently live. There are good arguments for treating early in order to limit the damage the virus does to the immune system at that stage. But that's clearly got a lot of implications about taking HIV treatment long term. Sorry, go on.
What affects where that set point is?
Really good question. And it's not absolutely clear, but it's certainly, if you have the good HLA molecules, if you have things like HLA-B57, which is known to be good for you in HIV infection, you're more likely to have a low set point. So it seems to be determined by the immune response, but it may partly also be determined by how virulent the virus is that you get from your partner. So it's a combination of those two things.
It's biological and
immunological.
Rather than lifestyle or anything like that.
As far as we know, it's yes. I guess the important question for sort of future medicine is, do we need to treat as soon as we diagnose people? because that stops all this sort of damage, the long-term damage to the immune system, or in which case then you make people... it's well known, for example, in treating people with high blood pressure, that once you start treatment, people feel ill because they didn't think they had high blood pressure, they didn't feel ill before, but they sort of become medicalized once they start treatment. And do you want to impose that on people with HIV for 30 or 40 years? But on the other hand, that may actually be the logical way to prevent damage. Sorry, yeah.
I'm sorry, I was just wondering, what about non-progressors?
Ah, yeah, very good question. Yes, I'll come on to them in a minute. And the other sort of big breakthrough, I guess, was understanding that the virus really, in that very early stage, most of its replication takes place in the gut. And that isn't quite kind of logical, really, because we think of HIV as a genital tract infection that then goes into the bloodstream. But actually where most of the virus replication is taking place is in the bowels, in the lymphoid tissue associated with the bowels. And most of our lymphoid cells, the T cells and B cells, the immune cells, live in the bowel. And that's the bit that gets really damaged very early on. And so these are studies that were done in monkeys, where you could experimentally infect them with an SIV. And you can the studies in monkeys, which obviously you can't do in people, show that you've lost almost two-thirds of the whole body's T cells within a few weeks of infection in primary infection. So you're already even though the numbers in the blood might be normal, these bowel ones have been damaged. And what's thought to happen then is that the damage to the bowel allows substances that the bowel wall would normally keep out to translocate, is the official term, but to seep into the bloodstream, and that kind of sets up this chronic activation that is thought to be so damaging in the long term. And if you have if your bowel is lymphoid tissue is preserved, then that helps a great deal to limit disease from HIV infection. But we don't really know how to do that at the moment. So the immune system is actually trying really hard to control HIV. And, you know, for example, we know about one in five of all of the immune cells that are targeting anything in the blood are targeting HIV. So it's not for want of trying. The antibody response is surprisingly late. Normally you make antibodies very early to things, and nobody knows really why it happens late in HIV infection. So you make some antibodies because obviously that's the basis of the diagnostic test, but you don't make neutralizing antibodies that actually suppress the virus for several months. And that's an interesting conundrum and may help explain why we don't control the virus so well. I think I've already mentioned the CD4 T cells go very early, especially the ones that are specific for HIV. And then the killer T cell, which is what our group works on, they are probably what keeps things down for whilst people stay well with HIV infection, but they also eventually fail. So the most vaccines work, we think, by eliciting neutralizing antibodies. So that's the obvious thing to do for a vaccine against HIV. But it's very rare for any infected person with HIV to make a neutralizing antibody response against their own virus at the same time as that virus is circulating. It usually takes several weeks for you to get a decent antibody response against your virus, by which stage the virus has already moved on. So the antibody and the virus are about sort of 3 months apart at any one time in an infected person. So you never really catch up with it. And people who've worked on neutralizing antibodies over decades have tried very hard to find what they call broadly neutralizing antibodies, which means antibodies that can kill or suppress many different viruses from different strains. And those are extremely rare. They have been found, but there's still less than 10 described. And that's despite a huge amount of US government money going into trying to identify these. So that, and it is possible if you pool all of these together, to suppress or prevent HIV infection in an animal model. But it's also known that you can develop resistance to all of these antibodies, even in combination. So antibodies is would be a sort of holy grail of a vaccine, but there are clearly very big challenges to making a vaccine with elicited antibodies. The T cells operate using these things called HLA molecules, and these are essentially allow your passing immune cells to survey the cells in your body. So most cells in the body have either a plus two or a plus one molecule or both, and they present different kinds. They normally, in a healthy cell, have bits of yourself on them, bits of your own proteins, and the immune system has learnt to ignore things that come from yourself. But if a cell gets infected with a virus or if it becomes cancerous, the proteins on the cell surface change to those from the virus or from the tumour, and that the immune system can tell that that is now an infected cell or a cancerous cell and responds to it as foreign material. And that's a very good way of getting rid of an infected cell, which an antibody, because it's circulating outside the cell, can't do. So this ought to be a good way of clearing infected cells, which is really the way that the body reacts to a number of cellular infections, which are particularly viruses and parasites. But HLA is incredibly complex, and this figure just shows how many new ones have been discovered since work started on this in the 1970s and 80s. And different populations have different HLA molecules, so the repertoire in a Chinese population might be different from a South African. And even within the same country, and I worked for a long time in the Gambia, which only has a population of 1.25 million, each of the ethnic groups has its own HLA repertoire. But what has come up time and time again is that if you have particular HLA molecules, that helps you control the virus. So if you have HLA B57, which is maybe, I would guess, five people might have in this room, and B27 probably only one of you. That's very good if you get HIV. Well, not great, obviously, but it's better than not having B27 or B57 because it is strongly associated with viral control. And probably the mechanism, although it's still not entirely understood, is that it allows T cells, these killer T cells, to attack and kill virus-infected cells through these particular molecules. And actually, I won't go through this in great detail, but there's quite a lot of evidence that these kind of immune responses are useful in controlling virus to low levels. And GWAS here stands for genome-wide association studies, which is a sort of trendy thing at the moment where you do a lot of SNP typing across the human genome in very large numbers of people. They're very expensive studies to do, and this highlights particular genetic polymorphisms that link with the outcome of a particular condition. And a lot of this has been done in HIV, and the only thing that comes up time and time again at the moment is HLA. So having it, you can have either good HLA or bad HLA for HIV, and that's really. But actually, we still don't really understand how good HLA and bad HLA works, and obviously that's not something you can control. It's something you're born with. So this lady gets a lot of bad press. She was the U.S. Health Secretary at the time that Gallo described HIV and announced that he had a test which allowed you to test the blood supply. And so this was a very important press conference. And she was asked about when a vaccine would become available, and she said it'd be available in 2 years. And in fact, she's always been sort of pilloried for this, but many in her retirement, she told a reporter that actually she'd anticipated the question. She knew it was coming. She'd asked Bob Gallo what the response should be, and he'd told her to say 2 years, but he never gets any kind of criticism for this at all. So just to go on to vaccines in general, Vaccine, sorry. No, it's okay. Vaccines Vaccines are obviously good. They prevent disease extensively. They're thought probably to save about 2 million lives a year. This is a baby in the Gambia who's part of a clinic which ensures that children get their vaccines on a regular basis and in the right order. And that it's clearly something where public health has done a good thing. But it's quite important to understand how vaccines really work. And the vaccine strategy, or at least the way of thinking about thinking about vaccines, depends on understanding protective immunity. And the story of protective immunity goes back to the Plague of Athens in 430 BC. And this was... nobody actually knows what the real disease was, but it was clearly a very virulent infection. It wiped out about a third of the population. So it was difficult to find people to look after those who were sick with the plague, because they'd get it themselves and then they'd get sick. Because it went on for quite a while in the population, they discovered that those people who'd had the disease but recovered could look after the sick people because they wouldn't get it again. And that's actually the sort of fundamental thing on which all our vaccines are based. If you survive measles or pneumonia or any of the other infections for which we have vaccines, then you have lifelong protective immunity. And that's really what we don't have for HIV. And this was adapted by Jenner in the 18th century to use a related vaccine, a related virus, which in his case was cowpox, to protect against smallpox, because he noticed that milkmaids who got cowpox routinely because of handling infected cows didn't get smallpox. So this was a sort of cross-immunity study. And he did things that we would now consider grossly unethical. He not only vaccinated children, who we now would consider, you know, they'd be very late on in the clinical trial process, but he also challenged with whole smallpox his first vaccinee. Unfortunately, the child survived, and you know, and now we have vaccine, smallpox vaccine. So going back to why we don't have an HIV vaccine, I think I've already emphasised enough about how variable it is. But it's also transmitted in different ways, whereas measles is only transmitted one way, so that's fairly straightforward. And the way in which we have developed vaccines in the past, which is by using either the Jenner approach, a virus that's very like the pathogenic organism but is attenuated slightly, or killing the whole organism and injecting that, probably do work in animal models, but they're not something that people would ever try for HIV. Although there is a group of physicians in the States who have signed up to have the first human live attenuated HIV when it becomes available, but I'm not on that list, and I don't know many people who would go for it. So that's a barrier, really. And as I said before, really, the point about the Plague of Athens story is that you do have protective immunity, whereas in most infections where we have vaccines. But if everybody who gets HIV, if you don't treat them, will eventually get AIDS and die, then no one has protective immunity. And so that's really a theoretical problem which has been hampering the field quite a lot. So how can we define protective immunity? The picture on the left comes from a place where Louis-Marie, who's in the audience, and I have worked in the past. There's a village called Kayo in Guinea-Bissau, and I'll show you a little bit about that in a moment. Guinea-Bissau is in one of the poorest countries in Africa, but it also has the highest prevalence of HIV-2, which is we've been studying as a way where we look at people who have long-term non-progression, which I think one of you mentioned a moment ago. So trying to understand protective immunity, one of the things that you can do is look at people who have controlled the virus spontaneously. And HIV-2, we think, is another such model. And the interesting thing about HIV is, despite its extraordinary variability and despite how variable people are, before treatment was widely available, pretty much all of the epidemics looked very similar. People that it was a nice median distribution of disease, that people with a median of about 11 years. So, you know, some people progress very rapidly, some people progress very slowly, but most people develop AIDS within 10 to 11 years, whether they're in Uganda or in China or in Europe. So at one end of that is the people who control virus spontaneously, and that they're rare, maybe 1% to 1%, and you, if they, if or perhaps less than 1%, if you use a very stringent definition, which has been fashionable in the States, called elite controllers, and they're probably very similar. But what we think is that most will eventually develop disease. It's just that they haven't done so yet. And it's curious that most of them don't have particularly strong immune responses, although there are some immune features that distinguish them. In particular, these HLA associations, these B57s, 27, and B51, particularly in Asia. And there are other genetic markers as well which associate with innate immunity. But broadly speaking, they don't seem to have better or stronger T-cell or antibody responses than people who are progressing mm-hmm. to disease. So there's still quite a lot of questions to be asked about these people. And the group in the States, in Boston, has collected several thousand to do very intensive studies, and that's something where results are still are coming out at the moment. So, as I mentioned, there are two forms of HIV, and the second form has not been anything like as well studied. And this is from the Citibank bee, this monkey here. So, you know, HIV 1 came from chimps in central West Africa, whereas HIV 2 came from the Citibank bees, probably in the Ivory Coast. And there have been probably at least 8 entries into humans, each of them with a different letter. But only A and B have carried on infecting people. And it's not a particularly successful virus in humans, probably only infected about 1 million people in total, and now seems to largely be going away. And we worked on this in two places. One, this is the Gambia here, and we worked on the coast here in Fujara, where there was an HIV big clinical cohort. And then down here in Kayo, which is a village in the middle of rural Guinea-Bissau, where almost by chance, really, somebody had noticed a clinician working in Ziguinchor here in the south of Senegal, had noticed that a lot of people coming in for treatment or for complications of HIV2 infection gave this village as their address. So it's not a very, it's quite a remote village. It's on a dirt road about an hour away from the nearest big town. It has no running water, no electricity, no sewage systems, and until very recently didn't have any mobile phone signal either. So it's quite an interesting place to work and to get to, not an obvious place to set up a lab. But it's been the study, the source of a lot of studies which I'll tell you about of HIV2 infection. But first I'll show you how you get to Kayo. One of the students in the lab, Alex, made this slide. It's only about 100 miles, but it can take between 12 and 24 hours, depending whether the ferry's working and what the border crossings are like. So anyway, this is the MRC Land Rover going. As it goes across the border, you try not to have money change hands. The Land Rovers used to carry paracetamol and condoms, which used to get us over the borders on the whole fairly comfortably. Their border officials were happy with that. The pig, I'll come back to right at the end of the talk. And then this one of the sort of real nightmares was this ferry, which is used to is the last part of the journey. You have to cross the Kashu River, and the ferry gets pushed out into the middle of the river by a tugboat because it's long since not had its own engine, and the tugboat lets go when the ferry is sort of about halfway out, and then it comes around the other side, and if all's well, it continues to pull you the rest of the way over, but there's a period when you're sort of drifting out to sea when you just, you know, you begin to be a little bit anxious. But in fact now the European Union has funded a bridge, which does make life a little bit easier. Anyway, at the end of this dirt road, you get to Kayo, and Kayo is a beautiful place. And if you haven't seen cashew nuts growing in their native situation, this is cashew apple with the nut on the end on a very hard casing. It's a subsistence economy. And what's particularly interesting is that this is an ethnic group that's quite distinct from the other ethnic groups in Guinea-Bissau. They're Manjaco, and they follow an animist belief system, very complicated rituals and age groups and so on. And as a consequence, they really haven't mixed in with the local other local Muslim or Catholic ethnic groups. And the whole population has been followed since the late 1980s. And at that time, 8% of the village had HIV-2 infection. Now, over the years, people haven't done anything any differently, but HIV-1 has come up and HIV-2 has gone down. And now HIV-2 is a disease of older people. And the whole cohort has been followed up over time with a small clinic that now provides antiretrovirals. And the thing that's interesting about HIV-2 is that unlike HIV-1, where, as I said, it's a normal distribution, only around 1 in 5 people with HIV-2 will actually progress to disease. But when they do so, they look exactly as if they have HIV-1. And you can't tell clinically or immunologically that it isn't AIDS due to HIV-1. Another difference is that if you're an older person with HIV-2, it's actually quite good for you. And there, if you look at the virological markers, the numbers of infected cells are similar in the two infections, but the amount of plasma virus is much lower in the people with HIV-2 than the people with HIV-1, which suggests a degree of viral control. So this isn't a sort of virus that's just a bit attenuated, but it has these two dichotomous outcomes. And this is a typical village meeting in Cayo, where everybody meets under the shade of these big silk cotton trees. It's a very beautiful place if you like trees. The way you can see this through epidemiological studies is, and if this is study entry, your viral load at study entry determines really your clinical outcome. So if you have an undetectable viral load, then survival is the same as if you didn't have HIV-2 at all, and your viral load remains undetectable for 15 years or so. Whereas if you have a detectable viral load, then it significantly affects survival. So this is an unusual model and quite different from HIV-1. And one of the big things that we were very interested in the Gambia and are still doing here in Oxford is trying to understand whether it's the virus, and at the moment we don't think it is, but we haven't got all the data yet that's different between these two groups, or immunology, or host genetics. And with our data, and I won't go into it in great detail because I think there isn't really time, but These two things seem to be more obviously correlates of protection than the virus, which, as far as we can see, doesn't differ significantly between progressors and non-progressors in the Cayo cohort. So in the interest of time, I'll sort of skip through the HIV-2. But just to say, because you mentioned non-progression, there are these different models, and that mean teach people different things. And the Sooty Mangabe is an interesting model. This is the natural host of HIV-2, and they tolerate very high viral loads, but they don't get this immune activation, and that may be how they've controlled the virus. Whereas people with HIV-1 are rare, and that may not be a stable phenotype. And the HIV-2 does seem to be a stable phenotype, and it seems to be in the majority. And each of these models teaches us something, but they're probably distinct. Now, we were doing quite well with these studies until the president of the Gambia announced that he could cure HIV infection in early 2007. And if you want to be entertained, there's a very nice video on YouTube from Sky News, who came to film this and sort of rather set him up. He got very upset about it. But it was a very real problem, unfortunately. The president, he could cure a whole lot of different diseases, asthma, diabetes, as well as HIV. To be eligible for his cure, you had to agree to stop antiretrovirals, which he argued were made by Westerners to kill Africans. So a lot of our clinic left to go for the president's cure, and many of them died. And it, you know, so it was a real tragedy, and it still is a major problem. And in response to that, the MRC in London closed the HIV program in the Gambia, because we, as the main providers of antiretrovirals, were in sort of conflict with the president. So unfortunately, that program isn't continuing, although we're using the samples that we've collected to address various questions in Oxford. I'm not sure that I haven't run out of time, so I might skip through these, the exposed uninfected cohorts and Nairobi prostitutes and things, and just finish off by talking about the vaccines that have been tested. So there was a lot of enthusiasm for vaccines that induced T cells for the reasons that I've probably described, that that they could recognise quite conserved parts of the virus, they could clear infected cells, but the best available T cell vaccine at the time was tested in people by the a collaboration between the company that made it and which was Merck and the vaccine group funded by NIH in the States. And this was a sort of profoundly depressing thing for the vaccine community, because the agreement was that the trial would be stopped when a certain number of people had become infected. And when it got to that stage, there was not only no protection, but at least the initial analysis suggested that it may even have done harm, that there may have been a slight increase in infections in the vaccinated group. That didn't actually get confirmed, but it did make the whole vaccine community very depressed for quite some time. And and so there was a lot of sort of soul-searching and hand-waving amongst HIV vaccine scientists. What's happened since then, and you probably do know about this, is that there is this is the third of the various efficacy trials that have been carried out in humans, did show some benefit. And I'm just going to talk to you a little bit about this, because I think it's quite important to understand the study. This was a trial of a vaccine that had been developed by the US Army, and in the components had never been tested exactly in this fashion together, but neither of them seemed to be particularly immunogenic. And there were a lot of people in the community, the scientific community at the time, who said this phase three trial, which was going to be expensive, shouldn't continue, and or shouldn't go ahead. And in particular, they said that it was unethical because it would go into a population who it would give sort of volunteer fatigue to the populations that did the trial, that were took part in it. And it was a huge waste of money to do something that was clearly not going to work. And a lot of very eminent HIV scientists signed this letter, which was published in Science around the time of the study. The trial went ahead because it's the US Army and they can do what they like. And but the really sad thing about it is that they, as a response to the criticism, they cut some of the science of the study. They went ahead with the trial, but what they were going to do was to take a subgroup of the study people, take a number of samples to look for how the immune response developed after the vaccine. It was that bit that was cut, and I'll come back to that in a minute. So then they did the study, and it was in low risk, in ordinary people, in fairly rural areas of Thailand. And astonishingly, really, to the community, analysis suggested that it was effective at a figure of around 30%. And there's been scepticism and enthusiasm for this response trial. So I just really want to explain to you what they actually did. When you do these kind of studies, you do you randomise, and then actually some of them were already HIV positive, so they had to be. They couldn't. If you do an intention to treat analysis, you have to include the people that you were going to treat, even if you had to exclude them because they were already HIV positive.
And then they went through this protocol. Some received the vaccine, some didn't. They followed. Actually, a surprisingly small number of people did everything in the right order. And that's called per protocol. When you analyse the data, you look at the intention to treat, you look at the per protocol, which is everybody who had everything in the right order, and you look at what's called modified intention to treat, which is everybody who you intended to give the vaccine to, but look, removing those seven at the beginning who turned out to have HIV at the start of the trial, which seems a legitimate thing to do. And if you look at that, then you only one of those analyses gives you a significant result. And that's why the community as a whole has been a little bit sceptical of this study. But I actually think it's probably pretty reasonable. It only reached statistical significance if you take out those seven people and look at the people who you intended to treat. And that sounds slightly paradoxical, because what you're excluding is the people who had all the vaccines in the right order. But that's because there's a smaller number of those, and the number of infections in that group doesn't reach the significance because of the overall frequency is too low. And I think what's probably convincing about this study is if you look at these Kaplan-Meier plots, so this is the rates of infection in over time. What it looks like, and this is 1 year, the biggest difference is at 1 year after vaccination. And then after that, the two lines are more or less parallel. So my interpretation, and I think probably this is what most people think, is that the vaccine did work, and it actually gives you about 60% efficacy in the first year, but it's a short-lived protection, and it probably isn't. It probably doesn't last much after that first year. So then the question is, how did it work? The problem is that they didn't take those samples because of the people who were so critical, so they only took samples every 6 months. So although you can now look back and see how did the vaccine work, the problem is that you're relying on samples taken 6 months after the vaccine, not immediately after the vaccine, which is when you'd see the immune response that the vaccine elicited. So that would be really where the information that you want is buried. So we may never know how this trial worked if it worked. And I think it probably did work, but actually the samples have been shared around the scientific community and people are looking very hard to try and work it out. But I think, unfortunately, because of these various political issues, the exact answer may not be known. And neither of these vaccines have been taken forward by the companies that originally made them. And there was no parallel monkey experiments either. So there's a lot of questions I think you have to ask if you're designing a clinical trial. It's great if it works, but then what do you do if you're in a position where you can't follow on from that and actually learn something yet?
Is it
reasonable
to say the vaccine works with
30% efficacy? Well, I think that's another question. I mean, it's statistically significant. RTSS, which the Gates Foundation are very keen to license for malaria, probably only works at about 30%. And, you know, that it depends on your perspective whether 30% is good enough or not. If you combine that with other methods of prevention, then maybe it's worth doing. I mean, it's not by itself good enough, no. But to have any efficacy at all is such a big thing compared, you know, after the result, the previous trials showed, you know, were absolutely comparable, placebo and control. So it shows that it did something, but exactly what it does, we may never actually know. So I'm not going to talk about anything else, I think, because I think I've gone on enough. But so I'll stop here and give you the chia. And oh, well, yes, that's what happened to the pig, by the way. So the student who did a lot of this, the T-cell studies in Alex Ligdovich in chia, was asked by the villagers to sacrifice a pig because she needed to appease the spirits, otherwise they wouldn't be happy for the her study to go ahead. And she was a vegetarian at the time, but she did a go ahead. And the first pig leapt off the back of the Land Rover and ran away into the forest and was never found again. So she had to go back and get a second pig, and this is what happens.
to pigs under those kind of circumstances. And this is this umbrella in the middle of the village square. It used to be the one place where you could sometimes get 2 bars of signal on your mobile phone. And so that was the place that everybody went to try and make international phone calls. So very, very interesting and fascinating place. I'd recommend it to anyone. Anyway, thanks very much.
Managed to follow even the most technological part. We've got time for a few questions. Are there any from the audience? I have a question to ask about HPA,
yeah.
Which is whether it differs by different ethnic groups.
HLA. Yes, and that I think is so, like a lot of these things, all the effort into understanding the biology of the disease has focused on Western cohorts. And so the B57 and the B27 are quite well defined in Americans and Europeans and Australians, but not so. But they're present at different frequencies in different ethnic groups, and the same studies haven't been done in as much detail in other parts of the world.
And that's also going to be a politically delicate subject.
And yes, so because obviously anything that involves genetics has, you know, ramifications. And do you really want to be in a situation where you're designing vaccines that are, you know, relevant for a particular part of country or part of the world? But that may actually be the way that we'd have to go, taking into consideration both the genetics and the virus strains in a particular place.
Are there any? Yes, we've got. Great.
Actually, sorry, following on from Lucy's question, I'm interested to know your views on HIV spread by dental secretions and by blood. So, can you? From your point of view, are there any immunological evidence to support why HIV has spread so prevalently in Southern Africa compared to other societies where people are also, you know, living in poverty and the political issues? And
yes, I think that's a really good question, and it isn't. It's been asked a lot, and it's not completely straightforward. And I think the social scientists here will probably know more about this than I do, but for a long time, the suggestion was that concurrency, so having multiple partners at the same time, was a key factor, whereas having serial partners,
you know... Attacked in the Lancet this week.
But and I think there were some other very good reviews of that earlier in the year from Foss Medicine, maybe, I can't remember. But certainly, I, from what I've read, that now seems to be, that's been challenged in some quite good epidemiological studies. Mm-hmm. So that probably isn't the key, which, having been thought to be. As you also know, sexually transmitted diseases facilitate HIV transmission. So, and it's quite clear that in some parts of Africa, acquiring HSV predisposes to getting HIV at around the same kind of time, particularly in young females. Yeah, and there's this rapid increase in acquisition of HIV in women in their sort of early to mid-teens, which is a very sort of scary thing. And it may be that the genital mucosa is particularly vulnerable at that point.
Herpes simplex.
Disappointingly, the trials for treating herpes, so people taking, you know, as you know, taking regular acyclovir, haven't prevented or had an impact on HIV transmission. There are other suggestions that baseline immune activation is higher if you are exposed to a lot of other things, and therefore that might make your cells and the genital mucosa more activated, therefore they'd be more susceptible to HIV. But as far as I can see, that hasn't been proven in practice.
Also in the Southern African population.
Yes, there are also suggestions that clade C, which is the main virus that's circulating in Southern Africa and in India, is more transmissible, and that may be true. But again, you know, good data are hard to find. So I don't think it's answered, actually, that question.
We can take one more question.
I was going to ask, you touched on it a little bit, but what do you think sort of the main international political barriers to the vaccine are?
Oh.
Or just if there's any in particular that you think intersect with the scientific aspects of it. I mean, you touched on a little with the RNC
Yes. I mean, I think it is difficult because, you know, the army study you refer to a bit in a bit more detail. They did modify their vaccine towards the Thai population, but it still largely contained elements of the virus that circulates in the States rather than the virus that circulates predominantly in Thailand. So, where the market is in the West. And where the need is in the developing world. And so there is really a sort of academic groups are much more likely to develop vaccines that target the populations that need it most than pharma. But you can only really develop this to the scale that you need it to be developed by if you involve big pharma. So that those kind of things are quite tricky, and so organisations like IAVI, the International AIDS Vaccine Initiative, are part of their work is actually trying to tackle those politics. You know, if we had a vaccine that worked, what would be the can you give the companies that would make it incentives, tax breaks if they sell it cheaply in Africa, so those kind of issues, I think. It's not, people have certainly thought about them, but at the moment, until there is a vaccine, they're academic. But I'm quite sure there'll be a lot more problems like that. And I suppose for me, one of the major things, having worked in Africa for a while, is that in very poor countries, the infrastructure of the health services are really geared towards babies, and that's where the health services work best. They immunise children up to about a year incredibly effectively. You know, the vaccine rates were over 95% in the Gambia, even in a place that mostly didn't have roads or electricity. So you have to be able to deliver all an HIV vaccine to kids, to babies, if you want it to target the whole population. There are virtually no mechanisms in most of the developing world to target adolescents. As we're finding with the HPV vaccine.
I would say a huge thank you. That was incredibly interesting and valuable. And thanks from the group.
Thank you very much indeed. That's lovely.
Our next session is concepts and advances. Do the team want to come up and start setting yourselves up for that? This is your moment to take 5 seconds to grab another sandwich or a piece of cake while we're sitting there.
Sorry,
are you shooting off?
No, I'm going to stay.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah. Lucy, I'm just going to move it a little bit closer to the podium so that the speaker can flip the sides.
Yeah,
without...
Well, let's just try gently, gently.
I can't see your sort
of reference.
Smooth.
Is that better?
Yeah, that's much better.
Okay, just check that it's all right.
I agree completely.
So I can't see that side, but Kira, can you just let us know if we're pulling wires out? I'm just trying to pull that across. It's better. Yeah? Is that okay?
Yeah, you go ahead.
It works.